Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Talking the Cure, Håkan Lovell's Life Sciences and Healthcare podcast. And my guest today, I had on, he was one of the first guests together with a former partner of ours and has one of the most successful episodes here. And I think I can't even count the numbers of emails I sent him and asking him to come into this format to talk to me about personal stuff and not really specific meta-related or topic-related. But now he's here. Robert Church, thank you for taking the time. Pretty late on my end. Hello to California.
Great, Julius. It's really a delight to be here, and thank you for your persistence and getting me on the podcast. I've been looking forward to it. It's just taking some time to get it scheduled.
That's the person I am. Before we dive in and get into the trenches about kind of you and your career and why you do what you do, can you give us like two or three sentences who you are and what you do, basically, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a partner at Håkan Lovell's in the firm's global regulatory practice. And in particular, the focus of my personal practice is on the Food and Drug Administration's regulation of the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry. And I do many things for my clients, again, mostly pharmaceutical and biotech companies. But, you know, by and large, the main focus of my practice is on drug development, clinical trials, and drug approvals, and to some extent as well, you know, supporting our colleagues here at the firm that are doing, you know, big transactions where we need to do, you know, due diligence of another company's pipeline as part of the overall transaction. So that's me, and in a nutshell, that's what I do.
I was surprised that you didn't start with clinical trials, because all the time I'm thinking about Rob Church, it's Mr. Clinical Trials, he and his team. If you have any questions, just go to him and ask him about this stuff.
Well, I'm glad to see that my personal branding efforts have been successful, because that's what I've tried to do with, you know, our colleagues and, you know, my clients, is when they think of clinical trials, they think of me. That's been something that I've been sort of working at for the last 15 years or so.
See, success here. Before we get into this, because I'm pretty sure you're going to share a couple of stories about kind of your work there, can you provide us an overview about kind of your career journey leading into your current role? And especially always asking the question, why pursuing a career in law?
Yeah, so, my father was actually a lawyer, and I don't know that I set out, you know, as a young person to kind of follow him into the law, but it was something that I was very familiar with. It always sort of intrigued me. And as an undergraduate in college, you know, I was pretty much always planning to go to law school, and I was even getting ready to apply for law school at the end of, you know, my four-year college program at the University of Virginia. And I remember very distinctly that I was collecting up all the applications for law school and taking the law school entrance exams and so forth. And I had this sort of moment, this sort of epiphany, where I realized maybe I should take a break from higher education, college and law school, and do something else. So I actually, another one of my kind of, you know, sort of ambitions as a younger person was to enter into something called the Peace Corps, which is a U.S. government program that sends, by and large, younger people, but not exclusively, overseas to developing nations to, you know, kind of help support communities that they work in and, you know, help with just overall, you know, development activities in those countries. And so I'd known some people who had been in the Peace Corps. Again, it was very appealing to me. And so I basically just decided, as I was getting ready to apply for law school, that maybe I would kind of hit the pause button on that and apply for the Peace Corps, which happily they accepted me. And I ended up living in Honduras for 2 years, where I was a Peace Corps volunteer, but always with a mind that I would probably go to law school after the Peace Corps was over. And so when I was actually in the Peace Corps in Honduras, I applied to law school, got accepted, and ultimately went to law school. But as a result of being in the Peace Corps, I had a very kind of clear picture in my head that at least coming out of law school, I wanted to do something that was sort of, you know, public service oriented, kind of, you know, following on sort of the work that I had done in the Peace Corps. And so through law school, that, you know, I had, again, sort of a clear view that I wanted to try to find some job, some kind of public service. And I tried different things. I worked for a public defender's office one summer. For another summer, I worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is a government agency that helps support developing nations. And then when I got out of law school, I clerked for a federal judge for a year and was continuing to kind of assess public service options. And I was applying to a number of different federal agencies. And one of the agencies I applied to was the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And they, you know, luckily for me, invited me up for an interview, which I went to. And pretty much right then and there, you know, the first set of interviews I had with FDA for a position as a staff attorney, the whole thing just clicked. Like I could see my career sort of spreading out in front of me and realizing that this was an amazing type of law to practice. Not only did I have the chance to work at FDA, where, you know, I ultimately went after my clerkship, but just kind of looking longer term in my career, I just realized that, you know, it was a fascinating field of law, something that I hadn't really ever fully considered before I got the, you know, the invitation to go interview with FDA. And yeah, and so just to kind of, you know, run through the rest of it real quickly, you know, I eventually wrapped up my clerkship. I started at FDA as a staff attorney. And actually a number of the people, four or five of the people that I kind of met in my early days at FDA, other attorneys there, are attorneys here at Hogan Lovells. So people that I've known for, you know, the better part of 30 years, I literally started my practice with them, and I continue to work with those individuals. And so it's been a, you know, very, very lucky for me, very fortuitous that I found that. I you know, I've never looked back. I've loved this area of the law from the start. The idea of being able to, in particular, be part of the process that brings new life-saving pharmaceuticals to market, like I say, it's always been very satisfying from both, you know, professional and personal standpoint. And just to quickly kind of round up my career, so I was at FDA for about 5 years altogether as a staff attorney. And then I moved out to California with my family in the late 1990s and moved in-house to Amgen, which is a large biotechnology company here in Southern California. I was their lead FDA lawyer there for a number of years. And so, and primarily focused on clinical trial regulation. That's really kind of where I kind of started out doing a lot of the clinical trial work that I continue to do today. So I was at Amgen for about 8 years. And eventually, you know, as I mentioned, I knew a lot of the people at Hogan Lovells already, and, you know, eventually transitioned over here. Very, very happy I made the shift. It was great being in-house, but also, you know, just the fun thing about working in a law firm is you just get to see so many different companies, so many different technologies, kind of just the advances in medicine. It's a lot of work, you know, working, being in a law firm, but it's also very kind of invigorating and very satisfying in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that would have been one of my questions, how you end up on the West Coast when you started your career on the East Coast.
My wife, who actually I met in the Peace Corps, she was also a volunteer at the same time I was. She actually grew up in California. And so, you know, we had always kind of, you know, had this plan that, you know, if the opportunity presented itself, we would move west. And happy that I did. I like being in California.
You already mentioned the field of law you specifically work in and that you do a lot of clinical trial work. But when you could pick specifically, what kind of case or specific area do you prefer?
It's a good question with a hard answer because, you know, I like working with lots of different companies, big pharma companies, you know, kind of mid-cap, you know, pharma companies, small, early stage biotech. I mean, you know, they each have, you know, kind of aspects which are very enjoyable, very interesting. I will say that I've been involved with a number of kind of early stage biotech companies over the years that, you know, I've kind of helped them through their clinical trials, helped them with their FDA interactions, and ultimately helped them get their first drugs approved. And that, you know, that's a really kind of unique experience when you're able to do that, you know, and you really help the company from, you know, pretty much the start all the way through, you know, getting to the finish line with their first drug approval and then seeing the drug get launched and kind of making its way out in the world. Like I say, I mean, that's kind of what I envisioned when I started my career, is being able to help with that whole process. And happily, that's one of the things I've been able to do here at the firm.
So a lot of sweat and tears.
A lot of hours, but, you know, as I said earlier, it is really interesting work. It's very engaging. You know, it is a lot of hours, but it's, you know, I really can't see myself doing another job. You know, for me, at least, I've been very, very lucky to find this, you know, good fit for my particular skill set and interests.
Hogan Lovells is a global law firm. When you just look at the life sciences industry group with a diverse range of practice areas, could you maybe share some of the kind of most challenging or interesting cases you had over the years, even when it's cross-practice or cross-border, even if it's not, it's just a basic success story you're super proud of?
Yeah, so I mentioned a moment ago that some of the best experiences I've had have been, you know, kind of helping smaller companies get their approvals. And I was actually kind of, you know, working with one of our clients a few years ago, where FDA initially said that, you know, the agency was going to deny approval for the product because of some concerns that the agency had about the conduct of the clinical trials and the reliability of the data. And myself, as well as a number of other colleagues here at Hogan Lovells and some outside consultants, we basically went out and did a full kind of reassessment of the clinical trials and the data, pulled together a very substantial data package, submitted that to FDA, addressing all of the agency's concerns. And we actually turned FDA around and ultimately got the drug approved. And yeah, I've been fortunate over my career to have, you know, a number of successes kind of along those lines, but that one in particular has really sort of stuck with me. It was just, you know, it was involved a lot of people in a lot of different areas, you know, both different experts at the firm, people internationally, but then also, you know, consultants on the outside. You know, we were heavily engaged with the company, its CEO, all of its regulatory people, its in-house lawyers. And yeah, so that's one of the highlights. You know, I've done some other things as well, but that one really sticks with me.
Is this then something which keeps you going on a day-to-day basis, especially when the workload is super heavy? And it's like this kind of keep getting people over the goal line?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, and just, you know, it's certainly not an everyday occurrence that I have that. But, you know, to your point, it certainly helps keep me going. I mean, just knowing that every day, you know, myself and the team of attorneys that work with me in the Los Angeles office, you know, we touch so many different clients, different companies, different products, different aspects of their business, you know, from contracting issues, from, you know, patient safety issues to sort of just regulatory, you know, sort of disagreements that a company might have with, you know, FDA or another authority. And, you know, just broadly every day, you feel like you're kind of helping the industry kind of make progress, you know, and sometimes in just sort of very small steps, sometimes in very, very meaningful ways. I mean, a few years ago, another, I think, you know, major professional victory for me is I was helping a pro bono client that was trying to bring to market trying to get approval for a new drug to treat a rare tropical disease. And, you know, this is part of a special program that FDA has to review and approve these drugs for rare tropical diseases. But in this case, it was a nonprofit biotechnology company. I did all the work for them on a pro bono basis, and same sort of thing. You know, they had a lot of issues with their application that they submitted to FDA, and we were ultimately successful in addressing all of FDA's concerns and helping this company get the drug to market. And, you know, in that case, you know, the drug is currently being distributed in sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, from what I know, it's been very, very successful and very helpful in terms of treating, you know, this particular disease. So yeah, just knowing that, you know, every day I, you know, sort of walk into my office, turn on my computer, check my emails, that there's going to be, you know, more challenges like that out there for me. It certainly does, you know, keep me motivated to keep going.
But how do you keep your sanity with all that? Obviously, California, which has pretty nice weather, as we don't talk about the East Coast and the rain they have to deal with all the time. I think work-life balance, and people are interested in hearing about how somebody who has such a high workload and demanding clients, obviously you provide a high quality service and the expectations are really high. So how do you do, and are you able to? That is more like the question.
It's always a challenge. I mean, you know, it's kind of a cliche to say, oh, it's important to maintain a good work-life balance. I mean, everybody does it, but actually sort of achieving that is tough. And, you know, there certainly have been stretches, you know, throughout my career, you know, when my children were smaller, and, you know, it was very hard, frankly, to sort of, you know, just juggle everything, you know, focus on your family, get the work done, you know, take care of yourself. You know, as I've gotten older, you know, through the years, I, you know, I've just, you know, hopefully sort of achieved a little bit more wisdom and insights in terms of how to do that. But yeah, I mean, I think it is important. I mean, it's impossible to do nothing but work all day long. I mean, you have to leave time for yourself. You know, as you say, we've got great weather in California. I like to be outside. I like to, you know, be outdoors doing things, you know, riding my bikes and, you know, going hiking with my dogs and things like that. And, yeah, I mean, you know, my children are all older now, out of the house, so it actually in some respects makes things a bit easier, because, you know, not chasing around to soccer games and doing all those things that parents of young children do. But yeah, it is frankly, I think one of the most difficult things to do as an attorney, as a partner at a law firm. But, you know, it is achievable. I mean, you know, there are plenty of, you know, good models of people who are able to do that. And, you know, happily in this day and age with, you know, the ability to at least work at home part-time, you know, gives you a little bit more flexibility just in terms of your schedule and, you know, kind of not having to commute. So that's actually been, for me, at least the last couple of years has been a real benefit, is just having a little bit more flexibility in my schedule like that.
Yeah. And Elon Musk hasn't finished the tunnels yet, right?
No hyperlink tunnels yet, but we're keeping our fingers crossed. And
so, coming back to the industry knowledge, the life sciences industry is constantly evolving. You with clinical trials and all this stuff are on the forefront, seeing products that are still in the air and trying to get on the road. And I asked Ellis the same question, where it was like, the industry develops more into, instead of taking care, of curing. Do you see it the same way? So that treatments are changing into actually cures instead of kind of a long-term.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to watch just over the course of my career. You know, when I started at FDA in kind of the mid-1990s, it was very much kind of, most companies were coming into FDA with small molecule products, you know, just sort of conventional, you know, sort of compounds developed through, you know, synthesizing, you know, new through chemistry, new compounds in the lab. And, you know, and of course, at that time, just the workflow, the process itself was very different. I mean, you know, fax machines, you know, kind of fairly limited use of electronic data transfer. I mean, just thinking back, you know, when I started my career, I mean, literally, like, when I started practicing law, like, email was just starting to be adopted. The internet was just starting to come online. And, you know, I remember, like, when I was in law school, we didn't really have either of those things. It wasn't until I actually got out in the workplace that I finally encountered email and the internet. And you know, when I got to FDA, small molecule drugs, right, which had, you know, basically been prevalent, you know, for the last 100 years. And when I went to Amgen, you know, which is a biotechnology company, they're really focused on, you know, macromolecule protein therapeutics. And, you know, that technology has been around, you know, a fair while as well. But I mean, you know, the biotech, you know, macromolecule protein drugs, you know, they really started gaining in prominence during kind of that second part of my career when I was in-house, or at least to me, it was becoming, you know, a bigger part of what I was doing. And obviously I was more focused on it. But I think what for me has really been startling since I joined Hogan Lovells is just the rise in things like cell and gene therapy, and not only the major technological advancements, but just the speed of change. Like, things are constantly accelerating. And literally when I joined Hogan Lovells, then Hogan and Hartson, back in 2008, for example, there were no approved gene therapy products. And, you know, the cellular therapy products were out there, but still kind of, you know, very much of a niche, you know, type of therapeutic. And, you know, now today, I mean, to the point that you're making, Julius, I mean, you know, most of the really exciting products coming through the pipeline, or at least many of them, are cell and gene therapy products, where, you know, in particular, when you look at, you know, gene therapy, the whole purpose of a gene therapy product, you know, more often than not, is just to cure the disease, just to sort of make a fundamental genetic, you know, transformation in the person to, you know, kind of, you know, cure them permanently of whatever disease they have. And in that, you know, my own sort of scientific training is not extensive, but, you know, just contemplating, you know, kind of the major advancements that have been made. And again, you know, being part of that and helping companies, you know, sort of develop those drugs and, you know, kind of gaining expertise and, you know, the specific needs for gene therapy trials and, you know, kind of what FDA's expectations are for those drugs. And, you know, we have, I think, as you know, Julius, you know, we have colleagues here at the firm who, you know, I mean, their entire practice is based on FDA's regulation of cell and gene therapy. Mike Druckmann, who's, you know, very, you know, colleague with whom I work very closely all the time. I mean, you know, he and I are constantly, you know, helping, you know, early stage gene therapy clients, you know, sort of, you know, address, you know, kind of the regulatory concerns that come along with that, as well as cell therapy, you know, didn't mention already, but, you know, the CAR T drugs, you know, Hogan Lovells was very involved in, you know, helping, you know, one of our clients bring the first CAR T drug to market, which, you know, are cancer therapeutics, which have been, you know, in many ways transformational. So it's been a really exciting time. I mean, it's just to have kind of in many ways sort of a front row seat to kind of, you know, observe all of these changes. It really is, it's an amazing thing to watch and be a part of.
One of the basic questions I normally ask is, how do you stay up to date? But I assume that a lot of stuff is just coming to you from a client side, and you are on the forefront and can then inform the colleagues to say, hey, actually, we have a new client and this is what they're planning to do. This is super interesting to be in that position.
For sure. It's almost impossible not to constantly feel like you're being educated in this job. I mean, just the flow of information from clients, a client meets with FDA, they send you the minutes of the meeting. You have to read those, understand those, go through all the background to make sure that, you're able to provide the right sorts of advice to the client. That's certainly a huge part of just my day-to-day kind of, staying up to date and learning about what's going on in the world. But I will tell you, and again, that this is also sort of, maybe kind of another maturity thing as I've, kind of progressed as an attorney. I actually do carve out a fair bit of time every day just to kind of do my own professional reading, kind of the trade press, for not just the law industry, just, in general, but also, the trade press for the biotech and pharma industry, kind of what the major, kind of innovations are, what the developments are, what FDA is thinking is on new types of therapeutics. And so, I found that to be a really helpful thing to do. And, in terms of when I mentor junior attorneys, that's one of the things that I always say to them. I mean, I think it's hard, especially as a younger attorney, to say, I'm going to carve out, whatever 30 minutes at the start of the day or the end of the day, or maybe an hour to just sit down and just do non-billable professional reading, just because I want to know what's going on. And what I try to impress upon younger attorneys, especially as they start getting a little bit more senior and start thinking, oh, I'd like to be promoted to counsel, I'd like to be promoted to partner, is you really have to do that. You have to have a wide knowledge base. When you sit down with the client for the first time, they expect you to kind of know what's going on in the world and, be able to speak intelligently about that. So it is a big part of the practice of law. And, like I say, fortunately, I've, over time gotten better at that and really found a way to kind of dedicate the time to it.
I'm going to add that into my brain list for the advice you're going to give in a couple of minutes to aspiring lawyers. One thing we have been doing, a two-part series, and specifically focusing on diversity in clinical trials. Me, as I'm a peasant and I'm not as educated as you guys are, it more likely blew my mind to hear about that. There's actually a lack of diversity in clinical trials. I didn't know when I joined Hogan Lovell, then I was educated, but before, it more likely blew my mind. And I really enjoyed these two series, and you have really nice members of your team who are actually heavily invested in that. Would you like to share a couple of things there as well?
It's interesting just kind of watching the progression of, kind of the clinical trial enterprise over the last, since I've been doing this, but I think, probably, kind of the modern, clinical trial as we kind of currently perceive it today probably began in the United States, sort of give or take, in the mid 1970s. That's when kind of FDA, kind of drafted and finalized its first set of robust clinical trial regulations. It became, throughout the 1960s and the 1970s, because of changes in the law of the United States, it became, a necessity to conduct, kind of a sort of wide range of phase 1 through 3 trials. And so the whole clinical trial sort of world that we see today, I mean, that's existed for, less time than I've been alive. Right. So, I mean, it's really, it's a mature process, kind of the clinical trial program, but people are still, it's constantly being, adapted and changed and modernized. And I think, kind of when I started out, again, in the mid 1990s, I think, it's just the main goal was just to enroll studies, just to find people who met the inclusion criteria for the trial and get them in. And, just the nature of the way healthcare institutions worked and, where the clinical trial sites were located, it tended to bring in, a fairly non-diverse crowd of people, right? Who served as the subjects. And I think, over time, this is, there's both sort of a health equity component to trying to enhance the diversity in trials, just a fundamental, social fairness kind of thing, that everybody's getting access to the same types of resources out there. But there's also, importantly, a scientific benefit, which is, you can generate better data if you're developing data in the whole sort of diverse, population of people in whom the drug will ultimately be used. So it's actually been really, really gratifying and nice to see that, that FDA and other stakeholders have really sort of you know, started focusing on this. And, you know, relatively recent, just in the last 4 or 5 years, has this become something that I think, you know, FDA and the industry is really starting to focus on. But it's been, you know, very quickly embraced. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that pretty much all of our, you know, pharma and biotech clients are really enthusiastic about this. I mean, it's the right thing to do from a social standpoint. It's the right thing to do from a science standpoint. And it also has been really beneficial just from like just a day-to-day clinical trial operations standpoint, like finding ways to open up studies to more people in more places, right? And that's, you know, I think that's really been, you know, another one of the nice benefits we've seen coming out of this.
Yeah, and specifically focusing on drug development, trying to figure out and to erase as many side effects, and you are able to cover bigger bases of patients. What else do you want, right?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's very well established that, you know, I mean, drugs will have, you know, kind of different sort of effects in different, you know, people from different race and ethnic backgrounds and, you know, people, different ages, different genders, you know, different, yeah, you know, I would say different ethnicities. So it is really important, you know, when you're generating that data that's going to support an approval and, you know, how to use the drug and, you know, what sort of side effects to watch out for. And, you know, just to, again, to have more data sort of coming from a bigger, more diverse population is better for everybody.
Thank you. That question wasn't included in my list, so thank you for being spontaneous and jumping in there. I mentioned a couple of members of your team in my question before, and I enjoy working with them. So when you sit down as the guiding partner and the partner of the team, what advice are you giving? And you already mentioned, keep yourself educated, make sure you're up to date when it comes down to our industry and everything which surrounds it. Obviously, there have to be top-notch lawyers, but there comes more to it to be involved in this practice.
I think, so one of the things that I tell all the sort of, you know, junior attorneys that I work with is, you know, obviously the practice of law, it's always changing. It continues to change, right? And I think one of the major changes that, you know, I've seen over the course of my career, and certainly, you know, I think anybody who's been practicing in a law firm has seen, is just that, you know, kind of the increased level of specialization that you'll see among attorneys, especially in large law firms. I mean, you know, doesn't apply to every firm and every practice, but, you know, I think by and large, when you look at bigger law firms, you know, you'll see that, you know, and then frankly, one of the strengths that we have at Hogan Lovells is that there are experts in, you know, pretty much for at least the area that I practice in, every area of regulation, right? Not just within FDA regulation, but whether it's, you know, antitrust regulation or environmental regulation. I mean, there's so much to know, and having a level of, you know, very focused expertise is incredibly valuable to our clients. You know, I mean, as you mentioned kind of at the start, you know, I made a very intentional effort when I joined Hogan Lovells that, you know, I was going to try to build a practice around FDA's regulation of clinical trials, right? And, you know, to think of doing that, you know, when I started my law practice, I don't think anybody would have said like, oh, you can be just a full-time clinical trial lawyer. They might've said you can be an FDA lawyer. They might've said you can be an FDA pharma lawyer. But they wouldn't have gone so far as to say you can be an FDA pharma clinical trial lawyer like that, maybe a little bit too specialized. But in this day and age, and again, you know, I think especially at Hogan Lovells, this is what we really see as one of our defining strengths, is that, you know, we have people that specialize, as I mentioned, you know, my colleague Mike Druckmann on cell and gene therapy. You know, we've got other colleagues that focus on, you know, FDA exclusivity issues, you know, orphan drug regulation, you know, manufacturing. So, you know, there really is just a, you know, a tremendous number of just sort of specific areas of focus that you can drill down on. So in terms of, you know, what I say to the junior associates that I work with is, this is not something you need to focus on today, but it's something you should reflect on and think about as you become more senior, which is, what direction are you going to take your practice in, right? And it, based on what I've seen over the years, I definitely think that this trend of specialization is only going to continue. To hold yourself out as just a, you know, a generalist healthcare lawyer, I just don't see today or in 5 or 10 years that you can do all areas of healthcare regulation, sort of pricing, reimbursement, approval questions, compliance questions. It's impossible. There's just too much to know, and there's enough other people out there that have taken the opportunity to specialize that, I mean, clients really appreciate it when they get on the phone with you and they know that you're the expert and they ask you a specific question. And you know that not only do you know the answer, the legal answer, but you've been through this a bunch of times with other clients and you have kind of the real world experience to know how what issues might crop up, how they can be addressed, and how the whole situation could play out. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the most important things for young attorneys is just to really try to picture, like, where is my career going? Like, if you're an associate at a big law firm, don't just sort of just go with the tide. Like, you should start, you know, not right away, not as soon as you start practicing, but over time, you should have a real clear vision of where you want to take your practice and what kind of lawyer you want to be when you get a little bit more, seasoned.
And do you think you need to figure out what your passion is in your profession? Because if you don't do that, you're not able to hold the line and hold the level you work on.
It certainly helps. I feel like I got really lucky that I found the world of FDA law. And then within that, I found a particular area of FDA regulation that I like, and that invigorates me. I really enjoy the intellectual challenge, just the day-to-day sort of mental stimulation of having to work through these sorts of problems. And if I didn't have that, if it was just a matter of just sort of doing routine tasks that didn't interest me, that didn't keep me challenged and engaged, it would be very hard to, I think, practice law like that. So yeah, it is important to find something that you find just really invigorating, something that even in your spare time, you'll just be kind of working through a problem, just trying to think like, yeah, this is kind of interesting. Like, how can I come up with a novel solution to this situation? Yeah. And I think that is important. And, you know, there's always a certain amount of self-selection that happens as well, right? Everybody comes into the firm with their own unique sort of set of experiences and, you know, kind of their own personal life background and what they bring to it. And it is interesting kind of watching over time, just the young associates, you know, slowly start to kind of fall into areas that that sort of work for them and are a good fit.
Thank you. That is helpful for everybody who's listening to thinking about branching out or taking that advice. We're more likely coming to an end, but this is the question I basically always ask. And you already branched out, so I think you're going to say, yeah, I already said it. But when you take a look in the glass ball, and I would like you to share your vision of the industry. So what is going to happen over the next 5 years, even with the speed we're going when it comes down to artificial intelligence and all that what surrounds it? It's pretty hard to say, I feel like, and because the developments are so quick right now. And the other thing is, what are your plans? So what is going to be the clinical trial guru till the end of the day?
Well, so yeah, so I mean, just in terms of my own personal plans, I, you know, happily I'm still enjoying, you know, greatly enjoying the practice, not planning to go anywhere anytime soon. You know, it's taken me, you know, a lot of years to sort of get to this point. You know, I've built, you know, what I think is a very strong team, especially, you know, the other attorneys that I work with in the firm's Los Angeles office. And, you know, as I said earlier, we can provide, you know, kind of an extremely broad range of services to our clients that are taking drugs through their clinical pipelines. And and it's, as I say, it's very gratifying to kind of like having built this up. You know, it's not something that I'm eager to, you know, say goodbye to just yet. So I'll keep at it for a while longer. In terms of the industry, I mean, I think it's a little, you know, everybody's talking about artificial intelligence. You know, it's a topic that's maybe a bit worn out at this point, but it's real. I mean, artificial intelligence is going to change the practice of law. It's going to change how the industry works. It's going to change drug development, drug discovery. It's going to change how FDA does their job. And I think all of us are kind of in the same boat, which is we're trying to figure out, like, how's artificial intelligence going to impact what we do. The one thing I will say for certain, and there's no doubt in my mind about this, is that I think the drug discovery and clinical development process is going to continue to get much, much faster than it has been over time. And which is a great thing. I mean, to the point, Julius, that you were making earlier, the sorts of innovations that we've seen with gene therapy and, you know, cellular therapy and CAR T drugs over the last 5 or 10 years, I mean, it's just been startling. Like, we couldn't have dreamt about this, you know, 20 years ago. And I think when you throw artificial intelligence into the mix, and just the ability to identify potential drug candidates, more of them, doing a better job of it, doing it faster, doing it sooner, getting those into the clinic, being able to sort of design and carry out better studies more quickly, you know, being able to identify potential adverse reactions and toxicities and ways of managing, you know, those adverse events in certain patients, you know, all of that, I think, is going to just leap forwards, you know, in huge steps in the coming years, in large measure because of artificial intelligence. So it's sort of scary just to think about, obviously, kind of all the changes that are in front of us right now, but also really exciting as well. I mean, it's going to be good from a healthcare standpoint, just in terms of more drugs to market. I mean, potentially, right, curing cancer and eradicating certain diseases. So it is an exciting time, brave new frontier.
I think that's a good point to end this conversation on a positive. Rob, thank you very much for taking the time. For everybody who's listening, thank you as well for taking the time to listen to us and listen to me talking to Rob. Please subscribe to our channels, subscribe to LinkedIn, Twitter. We are sharing constantly news around the industry. I'm going to link Rob's CV in the description. So if you have additional questions, please feel free to reach out. And Rob, again, thank you for taking the time. And for everybody else, here on the next episode when we're talking The Cure. Bye.
Great. Thank you, Julius. Take care. Bye.